This is Illinois Public Radio's live coverage of a debate between the two candidates for the U.S. Senate in Illinois, Democrat Barack Obama and Republican Alan Keyes. Tonight's forum is being held in the studios of public television station WTTW in Chicago. This is the third and final debate between the two men before the November 2nd election. Here to begin the broadcast is Bob Surratt, the host of Chicago Tonight.
Live from WTTW 11, this is Chicago Tonight. Here's Bob Surratt.
Welcome. On this special two-hour edition of Chicago Tonight, the two major party candidates for the Illinois U.S. Senate seat are across the hall in this WTTW studio, where Phil Ponce will conduct the final televised candidate forum of the campaign. We hope it'll give you a bit more insight into the qualifications, positions, and personalities of the candidates. We welcome public television viewers and public radio listeners tonight joining us from around the state of Illinois. For our local viewers, we'll have extended coverage here on Chicago Tonight right after the forum, beginning at 8 o'clock. Elizabeth Brackett will be here with a panel to provide analysis, and we'll also be at the post-forum press conferences of each of the candidates live. Then, in our Chicago Stories feature...
You want a winner, and so do I. That's only natural.
Rich Samuels looks back at two of Illinois' most respected United States senators, Republican Everett Dirksen and Democrat Paul Douglas. And later, I'll have one more thing about debates that aren't really debates. First, we go to tonight's forum for the candidates for the United States Senate. Here's Phil Ponce. Phil?
Thanks, Bob. Here with me in Studio A are two groups of people. First, in the audience, are members and guests of the City Club of Chicago. The City Club is helping to underwrite tonight's forum. With me here at this table are the two major party candidates who want to be Illinois' next United States Senator, and they are Republican Alan Keyes and Democrat Barack Obama. And a quick note on procedure. This is not a formal debate. There are no opening or closing statements, and answers will not be timed. The candidates will not necessarily be asked the same questions. Our goal is to better inform our audience about the candidates and the issues. We have a limited amount of time, and so we've asked the candidates to be succinct. If they begin to make a speech, they know I will cut them off. Mr. Keyes, as you know, 380 tons of powerful explosives are missing from a weapons installation in Iraq. Senator Kerry is calling it one of the great blunders of the war in Iraq. You have been generally supportive of the war, but what would you say has been the greatest blunder of the war?
Well, I'm not sure there has been, in my opinion, any egregious blundering. I think that there could have been a greater effort over the beginning of our efforts there to bring in others. I would have brought others in on the political side of the equation to help deal with the business of putting together an Iraqi government. I think that could still be done. But I think it's absolutely imperative that we keep the security dimensions of the Iraqi war under the control of the United States so that we can pursue what ought to be our main objectives, which is to make sure that Iraq does not become a base for terrorist activity, that we are able to make sure our government does not come to power that will aid and abet terrorism, that we are able to do what's necessary to prevent weapons of mass destruction from falling into the hands of terrorists. Those national security goals are the proper goals of our effort, and I think we ought to be looking to the Iraqi people and to the international community to help deal with the political dimensions of establishing a stable government there.
Senator Obama, you have been critical of the decision to go to war, but what would you grant has been the biggest success?
Well, I think that the initial military was extraordinarily successful in moving into Iraq, and I think that it exceeded all expectations, even those of us like myself who expected the military to be successful. The initial incursion into Iraq were stunned and impressed by how efficient our military and our brave fighting forces were in executing it. But going back to your previous question, I think that 380 tons of explosives that are now being used on roadside bombs is an enormous error, particularly when the Bush administration had been warned by the Atomic Energy Commission. I mean, in past debates, Ambassador Keyes has suggested that somehow I'm naive to question how we've gone about this war in Iraq. It strikes me that this administration has been naive throughout. It was naive in terms of thinking that we'd be greeted as liberators in Iraq. It's been naive in thinking that somehow this would actually diminish recruitment for terrorism. In fact, it's accelerated it. It's been naive with respect to how difficult it was going to be to secure the peace. And it strikes me that, unfortunately, our troops and our taxpayers are suffering from those errors.
Mr. Keyes, naivete on the part of the administration on those counts?
Well, I think we mustn't rush to judgment, because what I'm hearing in the media suggests that with respect to these tons of explosives, it's still not clear what the chain of possession was and whether or not it was, in fact, after the United States took possession, that we lost track of these explosives. I also think that all Americans are going to look at the larger picture of whether or not we have taken steps that have effectively stopped Saddam Hussein from delivering weapons of mass destruction to terrorists. The probability of that is zero. Whether we, in fact, have established a base that allows us effectively to recruit the kind of intelligence that we need to deal with this situation in Iran, in Syria, and elsewhere. Whether we have discouraged other terrorist-sponsoring states or potentially terrorist-sponsoring states like Syria, like Libya, from continuing with their activities in a way that could result in death for Americans. And I also think we have to keep in mind that the kind of things that we are doing in Iraq and in Afghanistan are only part of the effort we must make against terror, which is to carry the war to the terrorists themselves by every means necessary to find their cells and to wipe them out before they hit Americans. And I think that is part of the effort that does require both intelligence and discretion, and it is going forward.
Along those lines, Mr. Obama, name a key vulnerability or weakness that you see in Homeland Security that you, as a senator, would address.
Well, I think our inspections of ports. We are currently inspecting 3% of all incoming cargo. We could load up a cargo container. Terrorists could load up a cargo container and drive it straight into the middle of the loop without significant risk of them being inspected. Our chemical plants are still unsecured, despite the fact that we know how vulnerable they are. Our nuclear plants remain unsecured. There are a whole host of domestic priorities that have been neglected by this administration. And I have to say that, going back to the issue of Iraq, it is simply not true that Saddam Hussein was providing weapons of mass destruction to terrorists. There's been no evidence that that was the case. And this incursion into Iraq has resulted in a situation in which terrorist recruits are up. It's been acknowledged now by the Pentagon that the estimates of how many insurgents are active in Iraq is far higher. Terrorist attacks worldwide have gone up. They're the highest in 20 years. And the notion that somehow we are less vulnerable in the United States as a consequence of spending $200 billion and sacrificing thousands of lives is simply not borne out by the facts.
This is an area that both of you have covered throughout the course of your campaign. Let's move on to Israel. And Mr. Keyes, what role do you think the Israeli-Palestinian conflict plays in fueling potential terrorism against the United States?
Oh, I think that we have seen in the Middle East, unhappily, that in the context of the ongoing Arab hostility to Israel, it has become an incubator of terrorism. But I think that was partially because of the response that was there from the rest of the world, including some previous administrations, the Europeans and others, who allowed terrorists with the blood still dripping from their hands to sit down at so-called tables of peace negotiations in order to collect the ill-gotten gains that they had achieved by going after innocent lives. I think that's a great mistake. I think the Bush administration
The real question was, to what extent is the unresolved nature of the conflict fueling potential terrorism against the United States? That's what I meant to ask.
No, that's not the real question. The real question is whether or not, by making concessions to terrorists over the course of several decades, we in fact helped to create the mentality that has then led to a widespread and global threat from terrorism. If we had made it clear, as the Bush administration has, that we will not negotiate with those who practice terrorism, then perhaps we wouldn't have encouraged the adoption of terrorism as a strategic weapon on the part of some Palestinian groups, some in the Arab world, who think that they have gotten away with it, they have reaped rewards from it, they have killed innocent lives in Israel on the Achille Lauro, at the Olympic Games, and at each stage we were willing to go forward with a process that then rewarded them for this terrorist death. I think the real question is whether or not we shouldn't have started to say no to terrorism long before we did. Then maybe we wouldn't have been struck on September 11th.
Mr. Obama, your thoughts on the role Israel plays in the potential motivation of potential terrorists against the United States?
Well, I think that the ideology, the death cult that's perverted one of the world's great religions, doesn't need an excuse like Israel to engage in the kind of violence that people like bin Laden have engaged in. I think that obviously to the extent that we can arrive at a peaceful settlement in the Middle East, that would be helpful in draining some of the anti-Israeli and anti-American sentiment that exists there. But we've got to take more steps than that. I mean, one of the concerns that I have, for example, is that we have not been particularly aggressive in promoting the establishment of secular schools in the Middle East that would counteract the madrasas that are basically the only education that young Islamic men are receiving in places like Pakistan. So there are a whole host of issues that I think we're going to have to grapple with. This is a battle of ideas and not simply a military battle that we're engaged in the Middle East. And I think that one of the tragedies of the Bush administration is they've been very neglectful of that second leg of the battle.
Let me ask you this, though, along those lines. Today, the Knesset strong vote of support to Prime Minister Sharon's plan to withdraw settlements from Gaza. Is that a sign that the administration's support of Mr. Sharon is well-placed?
Well, I think that Mr. Sharon took an enormous risk and an appropriate risk in that particular circumstance, because what you've seen is a failure of the Palestinian leadership to clamp down on the sort of terrorist activities that have been taking place. And for the Israeli government to take this sort of unilateral step, I think, is entirely appropriate in terms of protecting their people. Ultimately, what we're going to have to see is the Arab peoples and the Palestinian people develop the sort of legitimate political leadership that is able to negotiate in a nonviolent fashion and have the will to clamp down on terrorism in a way that has not been done.
Let's move on to what I find
it hard to understand.
Go ahead.
Is over the course of time, you have criticized the Bush administration time and again for a so-called failure to engage in the peace process, when in point of fact, when they withdrew and refused to deal with terrorist elements immediately after they had attacked and killed innocent Israelis, they were in fact pursuing the very goal you claim you want to pursue. Because the way to discourage terrorist strategies is to make sure that nobody benefits from terrorist strategies. And that means that you have to be willing to back away from negotiations with those who are sponsoring terrorism, aiding and abetting terrorists, refusing to condemn terrorists, and who think that they can sit down at the negotiating table and reap the rewards of terrorism. And if you're not willing to make those hard decisions and stay out of the process when it serves the interests of the terrorists, then you're not serious, changing the way they behave.
I'm not clear about what Mr. Keyes is referring to. I know that when he was ambassador in an administration that was engaged in the Middle East peace process, that his administration, as well as every subsequent administration, has felt that the United States has an appropriate role in seeing if it can move the process forward. And I think for us to suggest somehow that we should abdicate responsibility entirely in the Middle East makes no sense whatsoever.
Let's move on to a domestic question, and it's a question that anyone who has an automobile is aware of now, and that is the price of gasoline. With gasoline prices as high as they are, Mr. Keyes, what would you as a senator do to push Would you, as a senator, push to require greater fuel efficiency from the automakers?
I think that the real question when you have high gasoline prices is to ask why the prices are high. Right this moment, I think that's kind of hard to explain, because we don't see anywhere that I can tell in the world where there is a problem with production or other things. So we'd need to examine that. But over the long term, I think we need to develop proper alternative fuels. I think we need to develop ethanol. We need to push on the research where breakthroughs are occurring to get hydrogen from ethanol.
Are you talking about mandates from the government?
We will be able, by pushing on that kind of research, yes, with support of government funding, we'll be able to have a win for our farmers in the agricultural sector to improve the profitability of their product. We'll be able to have a win on the environment because hydrogen, for instance, is more clean burning. We'll be able to have a win on national security because we will stop feeding dollars to Arab states who use those dollars to fund schools where people are taught to engage in terrorism and use those dollars to support the cadre and infrastructure of terrorism. So I think it's very important that we move ahead and we do so vigorously and urgently to develop a plan that will get us away from our dependence on oil as the primary resource and move us down the road that I think is going to be the 21st century pattern.
Any disagreement, Mr. Obama?
Well, I think one of the tragedies of this administration after 9/11 is that we did not move more aggressively on conservation as a strategy, in addition to developing alternative fuels. I think that increasing fuel efficiency standards makes sense. We could save as much in terms of our fuel if we increased our CAFE standards, fuel efficiency standards, as much as we would from getting Alaska drilling going immediately. And that's been the Bush strategy, is essentially drilling in Alaska, increasing production for oil and gas companies, subsidizing them to the tune of $20 billion, as opposed to thinking about how not only we can develop alternative fuels, but also how can we conserve energy and increase the sort of efficiencies that are available right now but have not been invested in.
Let's move on to something that's related, and that is the issue of the deficit. Mr. Keyes, name one program you would cut to help shrink the deficit.
Before I go there, one of the things that amazes me is that folks will always talk about how they care about jobs for people in Illinois, and then they will move down policy roads like CAFE standards that would further damage the manufacturing and industrial base of our own state. It makes no sense to me that we are going to take this country down a road that will damage our ability to maintain an expanding economy without need, by the way, when by achieving a proper balance between what's needed to create jobs, like Anwar exploration, and what's needed to sustain our productivity, and then put behind the kind of research that will make new breakthroughs in the energy area, put behind that the money that will then again provide more jobs and more opportunity for our people. So I think these are kind of contradictory. We want more government control that will restrict expanding horizons of opportunity and then claim we want to have more jobs for our people.
All right, leads to a broader question. Mr. Obama, what do you see as the role of government?
This is where we have a significant philosophical difference, I think, myself and Mr. Keyes. I think that the proper role of government is to do things that we can't do as well individually as we can do collectively. And that includes protecting our environment, that includes building our roads, that includes the national defense, and it also includes caring for people who are having difficulty caring for themselves and expanding opportunity for children who may be born in situations in which they don't have opportunity. And as far as I can tell, Mr. Keyes has a very different philosophy. His attitude is that government is consistently the problem. And I think that government sometimes is the problem, but sometimes government can actually help in terms of providing people the opportunities that they need and can correct market failures where they occur.
Mr. Keyes?
Well, if I can correct the understanding, I guess I am not obsessed with government. And that's the difference between myself and Barack Obama. I think that the first mission of the United States wasn't government. It was self-government. It was the ability of people to do for themselves. And in the business, for instance, of caring for themselves, of raising strong families, of producing businesses that will provide jobs, this is something the American people do very well. And I think the role of government is to second their motion. Government doesn't have an independent role of the people of this country. It is, in areas where it can support and facilitate their activity, it should do so. In areas that involve, for instance, opening up our frontiers and building the infrastructure that was necessary to support that opening, makes very good sense. Opening up scientific frontiers, such as we've been talking about with ethanol and hydrogen, it makes very good sense. Providing the kind of support for our infrastructure and transportation and other areas, it makes very good sense. But when you come in, as Barack Obama was just suggesting, and you start saying that we can better handle the problem of helping families that are in poverty, it turns out government doesn't do that better because there's a moral dimension to that problem where you need to give the help without undermining the incentive of people to work, without undermining the incentive of people to get married and stay married, which turns out to be one of the most important things they can do to get out of poverty. These are things that have a moral dimension that cannot easily be addressed by bureaucrats and impersonal policies. You need to have communities. You need to have churches. You need to have synagogues. You need to have the organizations that can walk with people on an emotional and spiritual basis.
You know, when a child doesn't have health insurance, they don't need a lecture. They need health insurance. When you have families that don't have housing, despite the fact that they're working full-time, and there's not a single metropolitan area in the entire nation in which somebody who's working minimum wage can afford a two-bedroom apartment and put a roof over the heads of their families, then they need something concrete. They may have exemplary morals, and they may be doing everything that they can to support their children, but they've hit hard times. And in those situations, I think government has a appropriate role in making sure that some of those needs are met so that people can ultimately do for themselves.
Nobody disagrees about that, but the actual factual record shows that the way in which we went about providing that help laid down rules and regulations that, for instance, penalized people when they got married and deprived them, for instance, of their welfare, drove fathers and males out of the home so they wouldn't play their proper role. Government did that with stupid regulations that did not, in fact, take account of the moral dimensions of the help that we should be providing people.
And Mr. Cruz
sometimes,
exactly,
if I may say so, you want to help folks, but the notion that you don't want to, quote, lecture them, to act as if the moral dimension of life, the kind of things that encourage people to meet their responsibilities to their spouses and to their children, to walk in a way that is disciplined and self-respectful, to teach the children that they have to have respect for the parents and that people in a family have to work together. I know government can't do that, but I know that churches and people working within their spiritual communities can. So if government wants to work with these problems, it should work through the institutions that represent the moral identity and culture of the people. It should not work through the kind of impersonal bureaucratic approaches that have dominated the socialistic mentality of the last several decades.
I'm sorry, Phil, because trying to get a little equal time here.
Ladies and gentlemen, please refrain. Thank you.
I don't disagree with what Mr. Keyes just said, which is why I've been responsible in this state for one of the most successful welfare reform programs in the country. We've cut the welfare rolls in half. That's why I've emphasized things like child support and providing mechanisms to hold fathers accountable for their children. Part of the problem in a lot of these debates is that you've got conservatives who will paint this boogeyman of liberalism, which dredges up every error that's been made throughout the 60s or 70s that had been cured significantly over the last decade. Will suggest that somehow people who are interested in government providing some assistance to people who are on hard times are somehow engaging in socialism. And that is completely off point, because what we're talking about is not socialistic programs. Mr. Keyes considers Social Security socialism. He's called it a socialistic program. I think Social Security is what has lifted about half of the senior citizens in our society out of poverty. And I think that is a good investment on the part of all of us, because when senior citizens are in poverty, not only do they suffer, but the entire community suffers.
How about the issue of the responsibility or the role of government in working with institutions to promote sort of a moral impulse?
Well, here's where I think we may find some agreement, and that is that some of the most successful government programs that are taking place right now are run through community development corporations. I came to Chicago working with churches on the far south side of Chicago. And when those organizations set up a non-for-profit organization and they've got a set of values that motivate and animate what they do, then oftentimes they can be much more successful in substance abuse programs, in programs for children, in building affordable housing. So to the extent that we can be wise about how we use market incentives for programs, to the extent that we're working with community-based agencies and organizations that are closer to the ground than a distant, remote federal government, then I think that makes a lot of sense.
But Mr. Keyes, let's move on. United Airlines just announced that it is adding 650 telephone reservation jobs in India and cutting jobs in this country. What specifically can you do in the United States Senate to keep jobs in Illinois?
Well, I think the most important thing we have to do is deal with the results of these unfair trade agreements that have been destroying the manufacturing base in Illinois, that have eliminated close to 20% of the manufacturing jobs in the state since 1998. I think that these things are the kinds of things that, with my background in international relations and my background in multilateral affairs, I know exactly why we're not getting good results, because the multilateral fora are biased against our interests, because other countries can gang up on the United States with some of the most privileged and better performing ones hiding behind the less developed ones to get deals at the multilateral table that they could never get at the bilateral table, get concessions from us we wouldn't otherwise make, refuse to make concessions in the multilateral environment we would otherwise get. So I think it's going to be very important to have somebody representing Illinois who will step into the United States Senate from day one with the background and experience already to command the respect of his colleagues as he addresses this underlying problem, which has to do with how we are approaching this complex issue of international affairs, but doing it in a way that's based on actual experience and hands-on understanding of what some of the failings are with, for instance, the whole concept of free trade. Barack Obama went to the Chicago Development Council and said he thought free trade was a good idea. I don't think it is. I don't think it's a good thing because I think it's a false notion, which is based on having Americans who have to build into the price of their products the price of freedom, of union organization, of representative government where you can get safety and health regulations.
All right, let's get Mr. Obama in this.
We're competing with slave labor from China, and it's just not right.
Mr. Obama, beat on your position on jobs for Illinois.
There are a couple of things that we can do. I think that we do need to enforce our trade agreements more effectively. When China devalues its currency by 40%, that has to be challenged within the World Trade Organization. It's not something that's being done. Right now, we have a tendency for our federal government to negotiate our trade agreements on behalf of multinational corporations and not on behalf of workers and communities that are getting hard hit. The second thing is we have to change our tax code. We've got a tax code right now that provides tax incentives to companies that are moving overseas. We need to close those loopholes and give tax breaks to companies that are investing here at home. We have to invest in infrastructure because part of the problem that we have right now is that not only are jobs moving overseas because those countries are getting more skilled, but they're also getting improved infrastructure. For example, in Brazil, you've got locks and dams that have been invested in that are far superior to what we have in Illinois. That doesn't make sense, and we've got to invest there. And finally, we've got to invest in human capital, which is critical. Our children have to improve their performance in math and science for us to keep jobs here. But there's one point that I've got to make, and that is Mr. Keyes's basic suggestion is tariffs as a solution to this, building a moat around America. I don't think that's an effective strategy. I think that, number one, globalism is here to stay. Number two, I think that we have enormous export reliance here within the state of Illinois. We are the second leading exporter of agricultural products of all the 50 states, and we would suffer tremendously from the sort of tariff wars that I think Mr. Keyes would be proposing.
Mr. Keyes, a quick response.
Nobody has ever suggested tariff wars. We have certain
tariffs.
Of course I have, because under the GATT agreement, for instance, certain kinds of tariffs are quite allowable in order to achieve greater balance of trade. We need to creatively use the tools that are available to us. Saying we should rely on these multilateral organizations, so where the deck is stacked against us, which can circumvent what ought to be the proper judgment of our own legislators, whom we elect responsible to us, and we should rely on their judgment to be fair to us when we've seen what they do to the United States in other respects, I think we have to keep sovereign control of our own economic destiny. And globalism should not imply that we are going to dilute the sovereignty of the United States when it comes to defending our manufacturing base and when it comes, by the way, to winning a better deal for our farmers. The notion that they have been getting something wonderful out of this free trade nonsense is absurd. Oh, sure, the other countries, Japan and so forth, they've cracked the door a little bit, but guess what? They haven't stuck their heads out yet, and our farmers aren't yet getting access to the rich markets that they ought to have fair access to as a result of these agreements. And it's time we started to ask why and stopped kowtowing to these multilateral mechanisms that are hurting our fundamental interests for workers and farmers alike.
Thank you. Let's move to the question of education. Mr. Obama, you've said that you consider education as the most important civil rights issue facing America today. Currently, your children are in private schools. If you're elected to the Senate, will you send them to public schools?
Well, my children currently go to the lab school at the University of Chicago where I teach and my wife works, and we get a good deal for it. But it depends on whether we move or not, and that obviously hinges on the election and what's going to happen. We're going to choose the best possible education for our children, as I suspect all parents are going to try to do. And that's part of the reason why, consistently, while I've been in the state legislature, I've tried to promote those kinds of reforms that would improve what I think is an inadequate performance by too many public schools all across the state.
But you're against vouchers. As a senator, you would have the means to have a choice.
Absolutely.
For your children. What about families who don't have the means? Is it fair for them to have a choice?
No. What they need is more money in their pockets. And that's the reason why I've supported programs like the Earned Income Tax Credit that provides tax relief to low-income families so that they can use that money any way that they want, including to sending their kids into private schools.
Is that enough of a help, Mr. Keyes?
I'm sorry. I do not see the day when every American family is going to be able to be employed by the University of Chicago so they, too, can have a choice. I think that we had better get there a little sooner than that. And I think the way we get there sooner than that is to let the money we spend on education follow the choice of the parents so every family in Illinois, whether they are rich or poor, will be able to have the same scope to do what they think is best for their children. I do not understand why we should believe it right to imprison the parents of people with less means in failing public schools, I'll let them have a little more money so that they can go on paying twice for education, paying with the taxes and paying as well with money they have to dig into their pocket to earn. One of the most touching things happened to me when I got to Illinois was talking to a father who had worked hard to send his daughter to a private school. He was a worker over at Ford, the Ford plant. And we were sitting there in the restaurant talking about this. And in the middle of it, he tells me that his son had died in a drive-by shooting. And I'm looking at this man whose heart was utterly broken and thinking to myself that for all that, he was still willing to make that extra effort to make sure that his daughter got the best. I don't think it should be that hard. We have the wherewithal, and in addition to everything else, if we adopted a proper voucher program, we would equalize the scandalous inequities in education that occur in Illinois because of the funding mechanism that leaves some kids stuck in poor districts. Give every parent the same amount that they'll be able to spend on their child, and you can bet in faith schools and parochial schools and other non-government schools, they'll be able to get better results for less money than we're getting
right now. Thank you. A real quick response before we move on, and we have to.
Right now, 90% of our school children go to public schools. Some of those schools are doing a good job. Some of them are not. It is absolutely critical that as we move, for example, in charter schools and encourage competition within the public schools, that we don't blow up the public school system, which essentially is what Mr. Keyes advocates. I mean, he has talked about eliminating all federal aid to public schools, the Department of Education. That is a 10% to 12% reduction in our school systems. 80% of our school systems right now are in deficit spending, 80%. And the kinds of proposals that Mr. Keyes suggests would essentially, over time, drain money from the public school system without any commitment that we would, in fact, create the kinds of private school system on a parallel track that would enable the children that he talks about from actually getting a better education. We need to lift all boats. The public schools were fine for most of the people in this audience and worked very well. And the notion that somehow the public schools can't work today, I think, is erroneous. I haven't given up on the public school
gentlemen,
system.
Gentlemen, he made
a false statement. I have not advocated eliminating all public monies for education. Never did, never have,
Mr.
don't
Keyes,
believe
that's not
it.
True. That's you're on record saying
excuse
it.
Me, I am not.
Yes, you
and
are.
And the truth of the matter is that it's not a question of whether we spend as a public, but whether we spend cost-effectively. And the notion that this drains
right.
money from
Thank
public
you.
Schools is not true. If you examine the case in Wisconsin and elsewhere, the more general the voucher program, the more general the choice was, the better the performance we got out
simply,
of the public.
Gentlemen,
I now want to get to a session which, for want of a better term, I call the quick hit section. Yes or no answers only. Partial privatization of Social Security for younger workers, yes or no?
No.
Yes.
Casino gambling in Chicago, yes or no?
No.
No.
Drilling in the Alaskan wilderness?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes?
Oh, I'm sorry. Pardon me. I appreciate that. We had already talked about it. You were going a little too fast. You're going too fast.
I thought we were about to make news here, Mr. O'Brien.
Almost. No.
All right, fine. Fine. The answer withdrawn. Cars that your family owns?
Chrysler. Is that right? Don't remember what it's called.
One Chrysler?
One Chrysler.
Mr. Keith?
Lincoln and Ford.
Reinstatement of the draft, yes or no?
No.
Universal service, also including non-military alternatives, yes.
Okay, let's move on to a political question, for want of a better term. The U.S. Senate is a deliberative body, Mr. Keyes. Can you give an example in your public life of where you've compromised for the greater good?
Oh, I think I have done it all the time. I think one of the things that I've changed my mind on in a major way was free trade. I was once a big advocate of free trade, as most conservatives are, but I found that the facts were simply
against
it.
I'm not talking about a change of mind. I'm talking about a compromise.
Well, I think that in the course of my negotiations in the United Nations, I had to compromise all the time in order to produce agreements with other countries. In the context of the North-South dialogue, I had to compromise on language, for instance, where they didn't want us to include a reference to the private sector in resolutions in the United Nations. They had never done it before I got there. Isn't that amazing? And so we compromised and allowed them to mention public, private,
social, cooperative, or mixed. We got a list of about five different kinds of things, but I got private sector in there. So those kinds of compromises were quite commonplace, where you insist at the end of the day that you want to push your point so that people will know that it's there, but you're also open to allowing others to express their views.
Mr. Obama, as a senator, what would your first piece of legislation be that you would propose?
You know, what I'd like to see is a continuing expansion of the Children's Health Insurance Program, something that I'm very proud we expanded here in the state of Illinois. 20,000 children have health insurance they didn't have. I think we can make sure that every child in America that doesn't have health insurance has basic care.
Mr. Keyes, because of your deep commitment to Christianity, what do you say to citizens of Illinois who are of other faiths who might be concerned about your ability to represent them?
Oh, I don't think there's need for such concern. I take very seriously the great American principles that we all have in common, starting with the Declaration of Independence, which says we are all of us created equal and endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights. If folks listen carefully, and that means you can't do it with the newspapers, you have to actually listen to what I say, to the arguments I make on public policy issues, they will find that in every case I reach my conclusions based on the civic principles that are the common ground of American self-government. Yes, they are compatible and in harmony with my faith, because in point of fact, if I had to take a position that was contrary to my conscience, I wouldn't be able to be a politician. These people who say, well, I think abortion is wrong, but I've got to stand for a public policy that pursues it, are people who would say, well, I think, I don't know, sex outside of marriage is wrong, but I'm going to be a porno star. You can't have it both ways. You can't engage in activities that are contrary to your conscience if you're a Christian. So I advocate the positions that are in harmony with my conscience, but I argue for those positions on the basis of American principles that I have carefully studied and that I apply in every case. I can make that case with abortion. I do make that case with traditional marriage. I think that you can make such civic arguments based on the common principles that we all share as Americans in order to make clear, because we have a moral identity as a people. There are moral principles involved in the foundations of American government, and we can reason from them to proper moral conclusions.
Mr. Obama, you've said that your religious faith dictates that marriage should be between a man and a woman. Would you elaborate on that?
Well, what I believe is that marriage is between a man and a woman. But what I also believe is that we have an obligation to make sure that gays and lesbians have the rights of citizenship that afford them visitations to hospitals, that allow them to be to transfer property between partners, to make certain that they're not discriminated on the job. I think that bundle of rights are absolutely critical.
But as far as why, what in your religious faith calls you to be against gay marriage? Well,
what I believe in my faith is that a man and a woman, when they get married, are performing something before God, and it's not simply the two persons who are meeting. But that doesn't mean that that necessarily translates into a position on public policy or with respect to civil unions. What it does mean is that we have a set of traditions in place that I think need to be preserved. But I also think that we have to make sure that gays and lesbians have the same set of basic rights that are in place. And I was glad to see, for example, that the president today apparently stated that he was in favor of civil unions. This may be a reversal of his position, but I think it's a healthy one. I think on this, President Bush and I disagree, apparently, with Mr. Keyes on this, because I think that that kind of basic ethic of regard towards all people, regardless of sexual orientation, is a valuable thing.
Let me interrupt and ask you a very quick follow-up question. Do you believe homosexuality is a choice?
No. I don't.
You think it's innate?
I think that for the most part it is innate. I think that obviously it may vary in certain circumstances, but I think that it is something that is a part of their identity. Now,
Obama, that being the case, if something is not a choice, if something is innate, then why isn't it a civil right? And why isn't your support of civil unions as opposed to marriage, does that amount to separate but equal?
No, I think there are a whole host of things that are civil rights. And then there are other things, such as traditional marriage, that I think express a community's concern and regard for a particular institution.
So marriage is not a civil right as far as you're concerned?
I don't think marriage is a civil right, but I think that being able to transfer property is a civil right.
I think marriage is a human right.
I think not being able to, not being discriminated against is a civil right. I think making sure that we don't engage in the sort of gay bashing that I think has unfortunately dominated this campaign, not just here in Illinois, but across the country, I think is unfortunate. And I think that that kind of mean-spirited attacks on homosexuals is something that the people of Illinois generally have rejected.
Mr. Keyes, on the Channel 7 debate last Thursday night, you said, and I'm quoting you, where procreation is in principle impossible, marriage is irrelevant. You went on to say it was irrelevant and not needed. What about marriage between people who are well beyond their childbearing age? Irrelevant, not needed?
No, it's simply a misunderstanding. The word in principle means relating to the definition of, not relating to particular circumstances. So if an apple has a worm in it, the worm is not part of the definition of the apple. It doesn't change what the apple is in principle. So the fact...
It retains its appleness.
It retains... To act as if concepts are laughable means that you want to be irrational. Human beings reason by means of concepts and definition. We also make laws by means of definitions. And if you don't know how to operate with respect for those definitions, you can't make the law. An individual who is impotent or another who is infertile does not change the definition of marriage in principle. Because between a man and a woman, in principle, procreation is always possible. And it is that possibility which gave rise to the institution of marriage in the first place. As a matter of law, it's still possible in principle. But when it is impossible, as between two males or two females, you're talking about something that's not just incidentally impossible, it's impossible in principle. And that means that if you say that that's a marriage, you are saying marriage can be understood in principle apart from procreation. You have changed its definition in such a way as, in fact, to destroy the necessity for the institution. Since the only reason it has existed in human societies and civilizations was to regulate, from a social point of view, the obligations and responsibilities attendant upon procreation. So when you start playing games in this way, you are actually acting as if the institution has no basis independent of your own arbitrary whim. And if you don't mind my saying so, that's what we just heard. We heard something that wasn't based on reasoning. It wasn't based on logic. It was based on vague feelings and respect.
It was based on your quote last Thursday night.
I'm not talking about me. I am talking about what Senator Obama just went through in terms of explaining his position. My position is based upon an effort, as conscientiously as I can, to reason through the challenge that we face when dealing with the most important fundamental institution of our social life and civilization. We can't afford, for instance, in civil unions.
We've got to move on. Mr. Obama, hold on, Phil.
I mean, you know, because he suggests that my position is illogical. Now, this is somebody who just last week suggested that the fact that gays and lesbians adopted children would inevitably lead to incest. There's no logic involved in that. That's pure vicious attack against homosexuals. It applies no more to gays and lesbians who've adopted children than it does to heterosexuals who adopted children. And Mr. Keyes will then back off and say, well, you didn't quite catch the comma there and the qualifier here and the coda there. But the fact of the matter is that it was a mean-spirited attack intended to suggest that there is some connection between homosexuality and incest. There was no logical basis for that. That was simply an assertion on his part.
Please. Can I do that?
Go right ahead.
Because it's actually very simple. I have over here two females, because I didn't talk about adoption. Those two females are intent on having, quote, having a child, which they cannot have, obviously, unless you involve a male. The procedures that are used now by many lesbian couples are procedures that mask the identity of the father, so it will not be known. Okay? So it will not and cannot be known who is the father of that child.
Isn't that true in many adoptions? No, excuse me.
I just said that a conscious, willful effort was made so that you could not know who was the biological father. Once you have made that effort, you produce a child who cannot know who its father is. Cannot know that. Now, if you don't know and have no way of ascertaining who your father is, then you can't know who your sisters and brothers are either. And if you can't know who your sisters and brothers are, there is no way you could avoid having sexual relations with them. And so logically speaking,
wait,
excuse me, I know that that Senator Obama sometimes has a hard time getting from A to B, but from A to B is a simple, logical step, which I believe most people in the state of Illinois have the common sense to see. In order to make an informed judgment, you must have the knowledge needed to avoid the consequence. And in that particular case, the knowledge is not available.
Quick response,
it is
Mr.
quite
Obama.
Logical.
I mean, according to Mr. Keyes, then, that would be true of any adoptions where they often don't know who their parents are. It would be true any time an infertile couple gets a sperm donor to help them have a child. I think your logic wasn't complicated. It was just wrong.
Well, see, but
so
ladies and gentlemen,
you know,
please.
The wonderful thing,
ladies and gentlemen, please.
The wonderful thing that one learns when one deals actually with logic and philosophy is that when I have a point proven over here, the fact that that same point applies in an entirely different circumstance does not prove the error of my logic.
It simply proves
that that logic may or may not exist elsewhere. If I have ascertained that a mistake is made over here, telling me that the same mistake may also be made over here doesn't invalidate the logic which identified the mistake. And that's where you're having a problem.
No, because you said it was inevitable.
General, let's move on. Entirely
wrong.
Mr. Obama, tell us about a time in your life when you experienced racism and what you learned from it.
Well, I think there are multiple circumstances. I mean, I think that any child growing up has, in this country who is an African American at some point has been called racial epithets. I think there have been frequent situations where I've been in settings in which it was assumed that I was the help. I remember actually when I first got out of law school and was being recruited by a major law firm here in Chicago. And had been invited to a fancy dinner. And as I'm walking by, wearing a what I thought was a pretty nice suit anyway, somebody turns to me and says, can I have more tea? I think every African-American has some experiences like that, but I think those experiences have slowly and gradually diminished over time thanks to the enormous efforts of parents and grandparents and others who made sacrifices in the society. And I am entirely optimistic that my children will experience an America that is less conscious of race and is less focused on the sort of discriminatory activity that's taken place in the past.
Mr. Keyes, you've said that you and Mr. Obama are of the same race but not from the same heritage. Do you feel you are more personally in touch with African Americans because you are a descendant of slaves?
I simply observed a fact. I didn't make any conclusions from that fact. I wouldn't do so. And I thought it was rather strange in the last debate that we had that when I talked about the effect of my heritage on my outlook, for instance, in dealing with the issue of abortion, one of the reasons I'm so intensely interested is because there's a disproportionate impact of abortion on the black community that threatens to reduce the numbers of black people in a way that will be quite demographically drastic over the course of the 21st century. I did misspeak a little last time because I had said that more black babies are being aborted than are being born. In fact, I think the ratio is 55% live births, 45% abortion. But, you know, that's still pretty bad. And it leads to a situation over time that's going to be awful for the black community. So I think that it has an effect on one's outlook because you look back to a heritage where things like the Declaration of Independence were critically important to making progress in the battle against slavery and in the battle for civil rights. The thought that we would discard it, that we would, for the sake of, I don't know, sexual license and other things, be talking about the world as if the Declaration didn't apply to our babies in the womb, strikes me as a devastating loss because I know how important it was to the progress of justice in the course of our history. So that's simply a matter of how that heritage influences what I have focused on in life, what I consider to be terribly critically and important questions of justice, how I look at the present situation in terms of the plight of the black community. I do look at the larger picture sometimes because I think it's well and good that we concentrate on helping people get jobs and education and do the things that are needed to meet the challenges of the present time. But if something's going on that's going to overall lead to genocide against the community in the long term, we'd better deal with
that too. Gentlemen, at this point I'd like to ask you to give me one or two sentence answer on the following questions. Mr. Obama, do you support either amnesty for undocumented workers or a form of a guest worker program? You support either of those?
Not in its current form. I think we have to secure our borders. We have to have employer sanctions in place. And if we have those two things in place, then I think setting up a pathway or regularized status for undocumented workers is appropriate.
Okay, and well, one or two sentences
clear
on that.
We need to have guarded borders. We need to make clear that the states and localities are not going to extend privileges to aliens. We need to change our basis for citizenship, because I think use soli, as it's called, where you're a citizen just because you're born here, is something that is contributing to this problem and needs to be changed. Right. And I think if we take all those steps in order to make sure we're enforcing strictly and can enforce our immigration laws so that we've applied to both borders what's necessary for immigration and national security, we can then move forward with an amnesty the way we did under Reagan.
Quick hits, yes or no? Federal funding to research new lines of embryonic stem cells, Mr. Obama?
Yes.
No.
Should the display of the Ten Commandments be allowed in government buildings, yes or no?
I think it depends. I think it depends on whether or not it's a historical building, in which case there's not a clear message of religion sent, or if it's one of these new large signs that are being erected in front of the courts, like what happened in Alabama, which Mr. Keyes supports.
All right. Mr. Keyes, quick answer.
Of course, because the federal government, through the judges or anybody else, has absolutely no constitutional authority whatsoever to interfere with the states in this matter, and it's provable on the basis of the clear, plain, non-interpreted language of the Constitution. The idea that it requires separation of church and state, right, that can be imposed on the states, so, is simply a lie.
This is something that I do have to address, because Mr. Keyes repeats this all the time. You know, he suggests that the separation of church and state is somehow an argument that he's having with liberal judges out here. He's not having an argument with liberal judges. He's having an argument with Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. Thomas Jefferson coined the term of wall of separation. Now, what he'll fall back on is suggesting that that even if there was a wall of separation, it would only apply to the federal government. But the fact of the matter is we've incorporated the Bill of Rights into to apply to the states through the 14th Amendment. That's the reason that the states can't ban this program any more than the federal government can.
All right. All right.
No, you're not going to leave that on the table. Yes, I am. First of all,
Mr. Keyes,
I'll do it quickly. But it's not fair that he should imply something entirely untrue. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion applies to the federal government. The 10th Amendment says all those powers not delegated to the United States or prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively and to the people. By the articles of the Bill of Rights, therefore, it is one of the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States to be free from federal interference on this issue of religious establishment. That's plain text of the document.
Yes or no, eliminate the Electoral College, yes or no?
Yes.
Yes?
I think at this point this is breaking down.
Thank you. Mr. Keyes, a few weeks ago, in this very studio, you told an audience of high school students that no matter the outcome, you plan to live in Illinois after the campaign. What specifically do you plan to do here?
I don't understand. I'm concentrating on my campaign, and I'm not worried about what I do in the event that I lose the election. What I plan to do is get a house, represent the people of this state to the best of my ability in the United States Senate, and make sure that the voice of their heart and conscience is once again felt in the councils of America as they were in the past, in such a way as to uphold the Declaration, defend innocent life, and promote the real interests of our workers and farmers through effective, competent representation.
Mr. Obama, where would you have your primary residence?
You know, we haven't decided yet. First, I've got to win an election. And after that, my priority is going to be making sure I've got as much time as possible with my wife and children.
Speaking of that, how does one balance the demands of something that is going to be, should you win, as consuming as the Senate, with that of a young father to young children?
It's an extraordinarily difficult thing. It's the hardest thing about politics. And the main way I manage it is just having an extraordinary wife who carries more than her load. And part of my task is just making sure that I'm providing her support as well as spending as much time when I'm not working with my children as possible.
How does campaigning affect your family, Mr. Keyes? You left Maryland.
I think the most important thing is that my wife and I do have a strong bond, and that we share a common faith. We know that at the end of the day, if we are walking the walk that God wants us to walk and we prayerfully consider what we're doing, He will provide us with the strength and the aid and the wisdom and the discernment to deal with our children and our family in a way that will not damage them for the future and will help us to do the work He wants us to do. And we're also supported and have been throughout our lives by a lot of people who are interested in what we do, support the kinds of things we are working for, who understand what it does to the family and who pray for us intensely. And we feel and are thankful for those prayers every day of our lives.
Mr. Obama, last Thursday night on WLS, you said that if elected, you would be independent of the mayor. The United States Attorney, Patrick Fitzgerald, has been involved in major investigations of corruption at City Hall. Are you willing to take a pledge that if the circumstances arose where you would have a voice in the matter, you would fight to keep the current U.S. attorney?
Yes. I think Patrick Fitzgerald has done a good job. I think that's one of the better decisions that Peter Fitzgerald made while he was in office. I think we could have found an independent U.S. attorney from Illinois as well, but I think that the person he selected has done an excellent job and I think deserves reappointment.
Mr. Keyes, you've run for the U.S. Senate twice before. You've run for the presidency twice and have never come close to being elected. At what point does it cease to become a useful exercise?
Well, I think that what you're doing when you stand before your fellow citizens to run for office is not about power and it's not about office. It's simply about standing with integrity for the truth that will best serve the people, the country, and your own children and the future of America. And I believe that's all that I'm about. And when I am running for office, even as now, I don't get up every day thinking about what's going to serve my ambition and what serves some useful purpose in that cynical way. If I have presented to people as honestly as I can things that I believe will help them to improve their understanding of the foundations of our way of life, to improve the way in which we maintain our liberty and our free institutions, to improve the way we apply those principles in order to secure our prosperity for the future and our strength and security in the world, then everything I do at every stage of my public life, win, lose, or draw, makes a good contribution to the life of my country. And that's all I care about, because along the way, as they say, you can do a lot of good. And it's up to God at the end of the day to decide in what way He is going to bless the effort. But I'm sure of one thing. As long as I walk the walk that He outlines and the path He wants me to go down, I will do good, and I will be happy with the result, because the only thing I really care about is whether or not at the end of the day I win the one judgment that matters most to me in the world, and that is when He admits me home to the kingdom and the place that He prepares for all those who have faith in His Son.
Mr. Keyes, among other things, at times in our history, the United States Senate has been known for great statesmanship. I know this has been a contentious campaign, but I'd like each of you to tell us something you admire about your opponent. You can take a minute if you can fill up a minute.
Well, I think that he has proven to be someone who's been able to make a very strong and favorable impression at a personal level on folks. I think that he did so in his speech at the Democratic National Convention. And I think that he's also obviously made a powerful impression on the media elites in Illinois and in other places. I think that is obviously something that required talents and abilities. I also think that during the course of the debates that we've had, he has shown himself to be both courteous and somebody who, as I've watched other debates around the country, is able to engage substantively on the issues at a level that I think has been helpful in clarifying the differences between us.
And let's hear from Mr. Obama.
Well, I think that Mr. Keyes is extraordinarily intelligent and passionate in presenting his views, and I think that no one doubts that. He also, by the way, has a nice singing voice, which we've heard on a couple of occasions. But you know, I have enormous respect, I think, for Mr. Keyes in the consistency with which he presents his views and what is obviously the heartfelt passion of those views. I disagree with some of them, but I think there aren't very many people who are better who can better articulate those particular positions.
And that will have to be the final word. Alan Keyes, Barack Obama, thank you for being here. And again, our thanks to the City Club of Chicago for helping to make this forum possible. For our Chicago area viewers, please stay tuned with us for an extended edition of Chicago Tonight, including post-debate analysis and live coverage of the press conferences the candidates are about to have in a different part of the building. Bob Surratt and Elizabeth Brackett will be keeping an eye on all of that. But for now, I'm Phil Ponce. Thank you for watching. Now a round of applause for our two candidates.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Obama.
Thank you. This is wonderful. You are terrific.
This U.S. Senate debate has come to you live from WTTW in Chicago on IPR, Illinois Public Radio.
Join us Thursday evening at 7 for By the People, Election 2004 from WILL-TV, simulcast here on AM 580. This week's program is a presidential roundtable, a discussion of the presidential race and issues affecting Illinoisans by local political scientists and political strategists. That's By the People, Election 2004, Thursday evening at 7 on WILL-TV and here on AM 580. Bob Thomas forecast for Champaign-Urbana. Tonight, mostly cloudy with some showers and perhaps a thunderstorm. The low 56 degrees with winds southeasterly to easterly at 7 to 14 miles per hour. Tomorrow, cloudy with a few showers, primarily during the morning. The high 65, winds northerly at 7 to 14 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy, the low 55 degrees. This is WILL Urbana, listener-supported public radio. It's 8 p.m. The BBC is next.
BBC World Service at 1 o'clock GMT. This is World Briefing. I'm Roy Larmer. For the first time, the Israeli Parliament has voted in favor of dismantling Jewish settlements on occupied land, approving the Prime Minister's plan to withdraw from Gaza. But two ministers have been sacked over their opposition. The settlers themselves are furious.
It's a problem that if we're willing to move out of one place in order to try to appease terror, then tomorrow we may have to move out of some other part of our country.
We hear from the settlers, from the Palestinians, and assess the significance of the vote in the Knesset. The authorities in Thailand say that there will be a full investigation into the deaths of nearly 80 people detained during a Muslim demonstration. A leading international medical organization says the world is in danger of losing the battle to control tuberculosis. And the British disc jockey and broadcaster John Peel has died of a heart attack. First, our top stories.
BBC News, I'm Francis Lyne. After 2 days of often heated debate, the Israeli Parliament has voted in favour of the plan by the Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon, to withdraw Jewish settlers from the Gaza Strip and a small part of the West Bank. It's the first time the Israeli Assembly has voted on the principle of removing settlers from occupied Palestinian land. 67 members of Parliament voted for the plan, with 45 against and 7 abstentions. Lucy Williamson reports from Jerusalem.
Having won the vote, Ariel Sharon is now facing an even tougher challenge: to keep his party and his coalition together long enough to implement his disengagement plan. 4 key ministers, including his influential finance minister and former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, have threatened to resign unless Mr. Sharon agrees to hold a national referendum on the issue. He has so far refused. The Prime Minister has already lost 2 members of his government. Shortly after the vote, he carried out his threat to sack 2 ministers who voted against disengagement.
The government of Thailand has promised a full investigation into the deaths of about 80 people who took part in a protest by Muslims in the south of the country on Monday. Thai officials said most of the victims died after they'd been arrested, many of them suffocating in trucks as they were driven away. Siasak Phongkekau is a spokesman for the Thai government.
The government is certainly treating this as a very serious issue, and investigations will be carried out to what actually happened. And I assure you that we will do our best to bring to light all the facts as to what happened to these 77 individuals.
The victims have been taking part in a demonstration in the province of Narathiwat against the detention of 6 Muslims accused of supplying weapons to insurgents. The Secretary General of the World Muslim Congress, Senator Raja Muhammad Zafarul Haq, gave his reaction to the deaths.
I think it's a case of gross violation of human rights. It pained me to know that they were surrounded, they were arrested, they were put in the police vehicle and then they suffocated. There should be an inquiry and those responsible must be punished.
You're listening to the news from the BBC. The international medical aid organization Médecins Sans Frontières has complained of global inertia in the battle against tuberculosis. It's calling for a new worldwide strategy to deal with the disease, which it says kills 2 million people every year and is in danger of spiraling out of control. From Paris, Caroline Wyatt reports.
Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, has called for a new global strategy to deal with the growing problem of tuberculosis, which the group described as one of the biggest killers in the developing world. The disease, once on the decline in some places, has made a dramatic comeback, especially where HIV or AIDS are prevalent. In the developing world especially, TB is becoming drug-resistant because patients don't always complete the long course of antibiotics. Médecins Sans Frontières says that in Africa especially, the combination of drug-resistant TB and HIV/AIDS is a time bomb waiting to go off.
The fate of the incoming European Commission will be decided later today in what's expected to be an extremely close vote in the European Parliament. Increasing numbers of deputies say they'll vote against endorsing the team named by the new president of the European Commission, José Manuel Barroso. The main objection is the appointment of Rocco Buttiglione, a devout Roman Catholic from Italy, as Commissioner for Justice and Civil Liberties. They're unhappy with his view that homosexuality is sinful and with his comments on the role of women. One of the most popular and influential music presenters in British broadcasting, John Peel, has died of a heart attack whilst on holiday in Peru. In his 40-year career, John championed obscure, anarchic and adventurous music over mainstream pop and rock. His long-running programme helped to launch dozens of musical careers, including those of Joy Division and Billy Bragg. After announcing Peel's death on BBC Radio 1, the station played his favourite song, Teenage Kicks, by The Undertones. Michael Bradley, bass player for The Undertones, explained how they and many other bands first came into contact with John Peel.
I think like hundreds of other bands, what you did was if you made a record and it was an independent record, you posted it to John Peel, Radio 1, London, and hoped for the best. And I suppose we did get the best, you know, he played it, he loved it and so on. So that's what people did in those days because there was no one else to send it to.
The American FBI has announced its agents have seized a painting by the Spanish artist Pablo Picasso from a house in Chicago following a complaint the work was stolen by the Nazis during the Second World War. The portrait, called The Woman in White, was painted around 1922. It was originally sold to a German Jewish collector who sent it to a Paris dealer for safekeeping. From there, it was looted during the German occupation of France. BBC News.
And now it's 6 minutes past 1 GMT. I'm Roy Laver. The Israeli government has managed to push through a majority vote in favour of withdrawing from the Gaza Strip and a small area of the West Bank. The Knesset was bitterly divided over the issue and the repercussions were felt immediately. Jewish settlers were amongst the first to respond. Anita Tucker spoke to the BBC from her home in Gaza.
I feel very, very disturbed, and it's a very hard thing to understand, and I think he's doing something that is not good for the country, because I think it's not a problem of Anita Tucker. It's a problem that if we're willing to move out of one place in order to try to appease terror, then tomorrow we may have to move out of some other part of our country.
The withdrawal plan was also vehemently opposed from within the ruling Likud party itself. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon even sacked two of his ministers for voting against it. Another four ministers are now threatening to resign unless there's a referendum on the withdrawal. Nonetheless, the government is claiming that the vote is a success. Salman Shoval is a senior advisor to Mr. Sharon.
This sets the course, I think, for political diplomatic activities for Israel, for the Palestinians, for the Middle East as a whole, perhaps, for a long time to come. The majority is also important because 67 in favor and only 45 against, I think in Israeli politics anyway, is a significant margin. I should, however, remark that there's still going to be a political test within the next 14 days because some of the present members of the coalition, including senior ministers in the government, have said that unless the Prime Minister agrees to a referendum within the next 2 weeks, they may bolt the government. And this could create a political crisis. On the other hand, a crisis postponed may be a crisis averted.
Well, a crisis averted is definitely not how Palestinians see it. They're furious that they were not even consulted. Senior Palestinian cabinet minister and veteran negotiator Saab Erekat.
I don't think that the Israeli Knesset has any right to determine the future of the Palestinian people unilaterally. What we have witnessed is Israeli Likud party negotiating with the Labour, with the Mevdal, with Shas, with the left, with the center, with the right. And the only thing that was absent from there was the Palestinians. What happened in the Knesset is not an internal Israeli matter. This is the future of my children and the future of the Palestinian people. So now the seriousness of the Israeli government will depend largely whether they will come back to the negotiating table with the PA or not.
The vote didn't come before considerable wrangling within the Prime Minister's own party. Mr. Sharon is well aware of the strength of the opposition to his proposals to withdraw the settlers, but he has refused to back down. As our diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus reports, it's not the first time that Mr. Sharon has had to make tough choices.
During his controversial military career, General Sharon was known as a daring commander, always eager to press forward. It was he who first counterattacked across the Suez Canal during the 1973 Arab-Israel War. But then he had the best part of an armoured division behind him. Today he is dangerously isolated, having been deserted by many of his Likud party supporters. A key group of Likud ministers who backed the disengagement plan are nonetheless insisting that it be put to a referendum, an idea already rejected by Mr. Sharon, that would enable the Israeli public to decide. This group, which includes the finance minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a rival for the Likud leadership, has given the prime minister 2 weeks to change his mind. If not, they say they will quit the government. And a key coalition ally, the National Religious Party, which also wants a referendum, has made similar threats. Palestinians are watching this unfolding drama from the sidelines, sceptical about the real significance of any proposed Israeli withdrawal. But in Israel itself, the debate is real and bitter. Many see the future course of the country as being in the balance. So can Mr. Sharon hold out with the help of the same opposition parties that helped him to win this Knesset vote? Could he seek to create a new coalition government, effectively orphaned from his own party? Will he back down and accept a referendum? Or will new elections have to be held? All bets are off, and Israel's often volatile political system is now heading into one of its stormiest periods within living memory.
Jonathan Marcus. Almost 80 people in Thailand are now known to have died after they took part in a protest by Muslims in the south of the country. The government has announced that it's to investigate what happened, but most of the victims died after they had been arrested, many suffocating in trucks as they were driven away. Kylie Morris reports from Bangkok.
Outside the army compound in Thailand's Pattani province, close to the Malaysian border, families spent the day waiting for news of their loved ones. The army now says that 1,300 demonstrators were arrested at the protests in neighbouring Naratiwat, but en route to the camp, as many as 78 people died. A forensic scientist who examined the bodies has said the majority suffocated, others perished through stress or convulsions. A number of senior officials have made reference to the holy month of Ramadan, suggesting the protesters were made weak by fasting. But a Muslim deputy in Naratiwat condemned the government comments, saying that it was too quick to conclude what caused the deaths. The chairman of one Islamic council has said that he's in shock, and while he doesn't know what will happen, he believes all hell could break loose. Even before the revelation of the much heavier death toll than was first conceded, Islamic groups had accused security forces of overreacting.
Kylie Morris in Bangkok. This is the BBC in London. Coming up in sport, Manchester United's Ruud van Nistelrooy admits to a charge of serious foul play after Sunday's bitter match against Arsenal. Today's main news again. For the first time, the Israeli parliament has voted in favour of dismantling Jewish settlements on occupied land, approving the prime minister's plan to withdraw from Gaza. But two ministers have been sacked over their opposition. Members of the European Parliament are due to vote today on whether to give their backing to the new European Commission. A large number of MEPs have said that they intend to withhold their support because of their opposition to the former Italian minister Rocco Buttiglione, the nominee for Justice and Home Affairs Commissioner. They are unhappy with Mr. Buttiglione's view that homosexuality is sinful and with his comments on the role of women. Our Europe correspondent Tim Franks has been following events at the European Parliament in Strasbourg.
Deep into the evening, MEPs, diplomats and Commission officials were discussing what if. What if the European Parliament says no to the new team of commissioners and they then can't take office next week? The fact that they've been talking so earnestly about the possibility emphasises how difficult this vote may be to win. Broadly, MEPs from the right support Mr. Buttiglione. They say the critics are conflating his private views with his public stance. MEPs from the left say there's no clear division in Mr. Buttiglione's politics and that the income incoming Commission President, José Manuel Barroso, has underestimated the anger and democratic relevance of the Parliament.
Tim Franks. Pentagon officials in the United States have confirmed that they're looking at possibly boosting the number of American troops in Iraq to provide extra security in the run-up to the Iraqi election scheduled for January. But they insist that no decisions have been made. Here's our Pentagon correspondent, Nick Childs.
The man in overall charge of the Iraq mission, General John Abizaid, has already said he expects there'll be a need for increased security forces in the run-up to the Iraqi election scheduled for January. In the first instance, the Americans hope they'll be Iraqi, but Pentagon officials confirm that they are looking at possibly asking some of the experienced US units currently in Iraq, like the 1st Cavalry and the 1st Infantry Divisions, to stay on beyond their current planned missions to help boost troop numbers temporarily. The deployment of new forces, like the 3rd Infantry Division, could also be speeded up. Currently, there are around 138,000 US troops in Iraq. Certainly few people in the Pentagon expect the level of violence to diminish between now and January, and many think it'll increase. Clearly, asking troops to stay on longer in Iraq would be a sensitive move. Officials here insist no decisions have been made, and may not be for several weeks. In other words, well after the US presidential election.
Nick Childs. Russia's President Vladimir Putin has taken part in a live phone-in program on Ukrainian television just days before the country's presidential elections. In a question-and-answer show which lasted for an hour, the Russian leader praised the work of the Ukrainian Prime Minister and presidential candidate Viktor Yanukovych. The event has been criticized by opposition politicians as the Kremlin's attempt to influence public opinion ahead of this weekend's presidential elections. Helen Fox reports from Kiev.
In an unprecedented move, President Putin broadcast live on three national TV channels in Ukraine. He answered some of the 80,000 questions that had been emailed in from viewers. He also took live phone calls. Russia has made it clear it would like the Prime Minister to become Ukraine's next president, although Putin stopped short of endorsing Mr. Yanukovych. He paid tribute to the Ukrainian government, saying it had made great economic achievements over the past year under the Prime Minister. This kind of broadcast is rare for Putin and demonstrates just how closely Russia is watching the campaign leading up to the vote on Sunday. President Putin is officially in Kiev for the 60th anniversary of the liberation of Ukraine from Nazi occupation. Opposition leader Viktor Yushchenko described the visit as untimely. He warned that Russia still had a powerful influence over Ukrainian politics and could sway the outcome of the vote.
Helen Fox. In a landmark ruling, Argentina's Supreme Court has upheld a government decree which forcibly converted people's savings in US dollars into devalued pesos during the country's economic crisis in 2002. The decision will come as a relief for the Argentine government, which could have faced a compensation bill running into billions of dollars. But for hundreds of thousands of Argentine savers, the ruling means that they won't receive compensation for the money they lost. From Buenos Aires, the BBC's South American correspondent Elliot Gotkin reports.
It was the Supreme Court's most important and controversial ruling since President Néstor Kirchner came to power a year and a half ago. In effect, it ruled that in times of crisis, the national interest is more important than the individual's. Great news for Mr. Kirchner's government, but a terrible blow for the hundreds of thousands of middle-class Argentines who lost most of their savings during the country's economic crisis. Before the crisis, the national currency, the peso, was worth the same as the American dollar. But as the country's economic problems deepened and Argentines rushed to take their money out of the banks, the government decided to act. It froze people's accounts to prevent the collapse of the banking system. The peso was devalued, and people's dollar bank accounts were forcibly converted into pesos, which were now worth a lot less than they were before. Angry savers filed hundreds of thousands of lawsuits against the government and the banks, demanding compensation running into billions of dollars. But the Supreme Court's decision means that the money savers lost will never be recovered.
Elliot Gotkin in Buenos Aires. The veteran BBC radio presenter John Peel has died of a heart attack at the age of 65. He was on a working holiday with his wife Sheila in Peru when he became ill. Famous for his shows both on domestic radio and here on the World Service, he discovered many bands which later on went on to become household names. Stephen Sveach looks back at his life.
Born in Liverpool, John Peel was one of the founding presenters of Radio 1, the BBC's first pop music station, when it was launched in 1967. Over the years, he became particularly famous for championing new music, even when it was strange or difficult. Artists like Billy Bragg and groups like Blur and Joy Division have credited him with helping to launch their careers by playing their music on his show. Gradually, John Peel's reputation also spread overseas among the millions of people who tuned into his programme on the World Service. Another BBC music presenter, Charlie Gillett, has this assessment.
He was a trailblazer without that being his mission. Nearly everybody who goes into music does so because they have a certain kind of, in a way, a narrow passion about something that they want to champion against all everything else. But John was different in that there didn't seem any edge to the music that he liked. In fact, he seemed more interested in going over the edge of whatever he liked to see what was out there.
But though he became a broadcasting legend, John Peel was an unpretentious man with a dry sense of humour who enjoyed spending time with his wife and four children. When he turned 60, he described how contented he felt.
I know I'm fabulously lucky. I mean, I do know that. Everything that I wanted when I was a kid, you know, a house in the country, not a big house, but a nice enough place, dogs, cats, an astounding wife, really nice children. I've had my rows with them on the radio playing records that I like, and I'm getting lots and lots of free records. It's difficult to think what could be added to this to improve it.
John Peel, who has died at the age of 65. Well, now it's time for sport, and for that, Lee James.
Hello, these are the top stories. India's cricketers fight back after Damian Martin hits his second century in a row for Australia in the third cricket test. And the Boston Red Sox look to tighten their grip on baseball's World Series in the third match against the St. Louis Cardinals. But first, football, and the Manchester United striker Ruud van Nistelrooy has admitted his guilt after being charged with serious foul play by the Football Association. This follows the Dutch international's tackle on Arsenal's Ashley Cole at Old Trafford on Sunday. Here's Alistair Eakin.
The Dutchman has apologised to Cole, but the incident will now be looked at by a three-man disciplinary panel on Thursday, and Van Nistelrooy will then be punished, probably with a three-match ban. It'll please Arsenal manager Arsene Wenger, who I spoke to earlier today. He was very unhappy about the challenge. He still has to explain his post-match comments about that and his criticism of referee Mike Riley to the FA. Wenger was furious at Riley's decision to award a penalty when Wayne Rooney went down in the area, and he stands by his comments that the referee didn't exert the necessary authority during the game.
I feel that on the day Man United didn't play with the right spirit, and but the game suffered from it, and that the referee maybe did not have enough authority on the game without interfering with any individual decision, and any suspicion about him being dishonest, not at all, but I just feel that the game suffered from it because he missed a good occasion. This game was watched in 75 countries in the world, and it was not reflecting what really English football is about and what I love in English football.
Moving on to after the match, can you tell us what happened in the tunnel?
Nothing happened in the tunnel, and I haven't seen anything wrong with it. And if somebody has seen something, they have to come out.
Arsene Wenger speaking to Alistair Eakin. Another leading figure in English football, the former national coach Kevin Keegan, is also facing punishment by the FA. Keegan, now in charge of Manchester City, has been charged for his outburst to referee Steve Dunn following his side's 4-3 defeat by Newcastle last weekend. And despite facing a touchline ban, Keegan is standing by his comments.
I shall write a letter of apology to the referee for the way I talked to him. But, you know, I don't take anything back what I said, you know, and publicly, in particular, where in the TV interviews and that, I haven't said anything that they can even take me to task over.
There were seven matches in the third round of the English League Cup, and there was one big upset in the northern town of Burnley. The Championship side beating their Premier League rivals Aston Villa 3-1. In the pick of the other matches, Manchester United beat Championship side Crewe 3-0, and Liverpool were also 3-0 winners at Millwall, where arrests were made after crowd disturbances. England striker Michael Owen scored his third goal in a week for Real Madrid to help his side to a 2-1 victory over Leganés in the Copa del Rey. Fernando Morientes was also on the score sheet. Deportivo La Coruña ran out comfortable 2-0 winners at Cesida, but Osasuna needed penalties to see off Castellón after their game finished goalless. In Germany, the Bundesliga leaders Wolfsburg lost 2-0 to Bayern Munich, who closed the gap to just 1 point. Elsewhere, Kaiserslautern remained bottom after losing 3-0 at Hanover. There were wins for Borussia Dortmund and VfL Bochum. Al-Ittihad of Saudi Arabia are through to the Asian Champions League final. In Seoul, they drew 2-2 with Chungwook Motors of South Korea in the second leg of the semi-final. They won the first leg in Saudi Arabia 2-1. Damien Martin has put Australia in a strong position after the first day of the third cricket test against India at Nagpur. The tourists, already 1-0 up in the series, closed on 362 for 7. Martin top scored on 114. Reporting from Nagpur is Jim Maxwell.
Damien Martin's ninth test century guided Australia to a healthy score. He shared a century partnership with Lehman after Australia had lost 3 wickets to slip from none for 67 to 3 for 86. Lehman's fluency was interrupted by a hamstring injury, and with Hayden acting as a runner, he lost his wicket to Dravid's catch at slip off Kartik for 70. Martin reached a chanceless 100 with superb cuts and drives, eventually skying a catch to Agarkar from Kumble. Quick dismissals of Gilchrist and Warne gave India an opportunity to bowl Australia out, but the walking forward defence of Gillespie and the twinkle-toed Clark held out. Clark was badly missed by Patel on 66, his 73, Gillespie 4, Australia grabbing the early momentum on the firmest, grassiest pitch of the series at 7 for 362.
Meanwhile, the New Zealand captain, Stephen Fleming, has put his side in a commanding position after the opening day of the second test against Bangladesh in Chittagong. Making a record 87th test appearance, Fleming was 137 not out as New Zealand reached 338 for 3 at the close. And afterwards was quick to pay tribute to Martin Crowe, the man he surpassed as New Zealand's highest test run scorer.
I went past our finest batsman ever, and I'm obviously very proud to do that. I know that he would have wanted to post more runs in terms of his record, which injury cut him short, but also respect how great a player he was and how inspirational he's been to me in terms of motivation and assistance. So a very proud moment to go past him. And also a salute to him that I know as well as everybody else that he would have posted more runs at a better rate as well because he was a fine player.
Bennett King is expected to become the first foreign coach to guide West Indies. The 39-year-old head coach of the Australian Cricket Academy has accepted the job and the West Indies Cricket Board plan to confirm his appointment next week. King replaces Gus Logie, who was sacked after the side won the Champions Trophy in England last month. The third match in baseball's World Series is underway. The Boston Red Sox, who haven't won the World Series since 1918, hold a 2-0 lead over the St. Louis Cardinals. Let's get the latest from our reporter at St. Louis's Busch Stadium, Jim Hollis.
And in the top of the third inning here, the best Boston Red Sox lead St. Louis by a 1-0. And it's their big hitter from the Dominican Republic, Manny Ramirez, who's done the damage. He dispatched a pitch from Jeff Suppan about 400 feet over the fence in left field to put the Red Sox ahead. Now, Manny's not known for being a great fielder. He's a great hitter, not a great fielder. But he did his fellow countryman Pedro Martinez a huge favour in the bottom of the first. The ace pitcher for the Red Sox allowed 3 straight Cardinals hitters to reach base, but with one man out, Ramirez made a terrifically well-judged catch off Jim Edmonds and then threw out Larry Walker at home plate to end the inning. It served to quieten the raucous 53,000 crowd here. They're really waiting for something to cheer and get excited about. In the top of the third, it's St. Louis 0, Boston 1.
Thanks, Jim. The possibility of a new Grand Prix series to rival Formula One appears to have moved a step closer. GPWC Holdings, a group which includes some of the leading car manufacturers, has appointed a consultancy firm to produce an operational and commercial structure for a new series to begin no later than 2008. The group is unhappy with the way Formula One, led by the promoter Bernie Eccleston, currently divides up the commercial rights. But the BBC's Andrew Benson says the move is simply a negotiation mechanism.
This is a very complicated issue, and it's all tied up with a lot of political arguments that are going on in Formula One about the sport's future at the moment, to do with cost cutting and the distribution of income within the sport. I think that there's nobody within Formula One who really thinks that there'll be a breakaway championship in 2008, but the car manufacturers involved are using it as a bargaining ploy to try to get more money out of Bernie Eccleston, the commercial boss of Formula One.
And finally, the world number two golfer Ernie Els has pulled out of this week's Chrysler Championship in Florida due to a finger injury. That's the latest sport.
And today's main news again, the Israeli parliament has voted in favour of the plan by the Prime Minister Ariel Sharon to withdraw Jewish settlers from the Gaza Strip and a small part of the West Bank. I'm Roy Larmer, this is the BBC in London.
Distribution of BBC World Service in the United States is by Public Radio International and is made possible by PRI's Producers Forum donors, whose annual contributions help bring innovation and diversity to public radio programming, and with the support of the pharmaceutical company Merck, helping to expand access to its HIV/AIDS medicines for the world's poorest countries and those hardest hit by the epidemic. Merck, where patients come first. More at Merck.com.